Hey, this is Steve, and this podcast is all about making the gospel relevant to your life. That means discovering the good news of Jesus no matter what you're going through today. And today, we believers find it increasingly difficult to navigate our non-believer culture, much like Daniel did. He began to be a believer in a non-believer culture when he was a teenager, yet he stood as a man of godly integrity all the way into his 70s. How did he do that? And how can we as believers be people of godly integrity in our non-believer culture? Good Jewish kid, probably a 13, 14-year-old kid, taken from his home in Israel, taken captive, and been made to serve the king in Babylon. And Daniel's been doing this now, by the time we pick up this story today, he's been doing this now for decades. By the time we pick up the story today, we find Daniel to be no longer a young kid, but an old man. Daniel now is in his 70s, and kings have come and gone. In fact, an entire kingdom has come and gone because Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, is the one that took him and his buddies. And now Babylon, by this time in the story, Babylon has even been overtaken by Persia. And now there is a Persian king, King Darius the Mede. And so there has been a lot of change for Daniel, a lot of change. The culture is changing, the times are changing, but Daniel is doing the same thing that he's been doing. Daniel continues to serve in his position there in Babylon and now known as Persia. And he continues to serve because he remembers the words of Jeremiah that God put you there to work for the peace, for the shalom of the city, of the culture, of the people there. And so he's been doing that all along, realizing that he's not living in the promised land anymore, but he's living in exile. And first blank on your page, like Daniel, I am living in exile. You and I realize we don't belong here, right? This world isn't our home. In fact, the more that Jesus does his work in me, the more I realize that who he's making me is diametrically opposed to what the world says I should be, right? Jesus himself said in John 18, he said, "My kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. If it were, my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish leaders. But my kingdom," Jesus says, "my kingdom is not of this world." You and I are in this world, but we are not of this world. We're living as exiles in a foreign land. And like Daniel, we've been placed here to work for the peace of the city, the shalom of the city. And that's exactly what Daniel is doing. So we're going to pick up his story in Daniel 6 today, and we're going to find Daniel as that old man continuing to serve faithfully. In Daniel 6:1, Darius the Mede decided to divide the kingdom into 120 provinces, and he appointed a high officer to rule over each province. The king also chose Daniel and two others as administrators to supervise the high officers and protect the king's interest. Daniel soon proved himself more capable than all the other administrators and high officers. Because of Daniel's great ability, the king made plans to place him over the entire empire. Wow. So here we are, I think, on the third king that Daniel serves, the second kingdom that Daniel is serving, and he's found to be faithful. All throughout his life, from the time he was a teenager to now when he's probably in his 70s, he's being found faithful. He's being found to continue to serve where he's been placed. I had a friend who used to always say, bloom where you're planted. And that's exactly what Daniel's doing. He is being everything he can be for his community, for his culture, to bring shalom, to bring peace. And you're seeing that he is a man of integrity. He's a man who is willing to do what he must do, and he's doing it right. And the kings loved him for it. All the kings that he worked for loved him. They kept promoting him higher and higher. The kings loved him. When we serve with integrity, our bosses will love us. Right? Because if you're really blooming where you are planted, you're serving in your job, you're serving in your marriage, you're serving in your neighborhood. As you're serving there, the leaders ought to love you, because you're doing everything you can to work for the shalom of your marriage, the shalom of your neighborhood, and the shalom of your employment, of your job. Is that us? I mean, can people look to us and say, that person is a peacemaker? He's a shalom bringer. So the kings always wanted to elevate Daniel higher and higher, and this was really good for Daniel, but it wasn't good for everybody. Not everybody loved Daniel. And look at verse 4. Then the other administrators and the high officers began searching for some fault in the way Daniel was handling government affairs. But they couldn't find anything to criticize or condemn. He was faithful, always responsible, and completely trustworthy. So they're trying to find some fault. They're trying to find some way to blame him. I can't believe this guy keeps getting promoted. He's this Jewish guy. He's got this awkward, weird religion. It doesn't fit with what we're doing, and he keeps getting promoted. This cannot be the case. We got to stop this. We got to bring this guy back down again. We've all worked hard to be able to get up the ranks. And so there's got to be some way we can bring him back down again. Surely we can find a skeleton in Daniel's closet, right? Surely we can find some reason that he doesn't belong where he belongs. Because, I mean, there's no way this guy got where he's gotten by the rules, right? I mean, we sure didn't. Surely Daniel, like us, has bribed someone, bought somebody off, lied to somebody, cheated in some way, gotten where he is by some crooked means, and we can find some skeleton and we can maybe take him out. But they weren't able to. Daniel was always faithful, always responsible, and completely trustworthy. Why is this true about Daniel? Why is it that we're looking at this guy over the course of all these decades to find that he's this way? And the truth is, the next blank on your page, that exiles live for another kingdom. Exiles live for another kingdom. Daniel was placed there in Babylon, now called Persia, to bring the shalom of his kingdom, the kingdom of God, into the kingdom of the world. That's what he was there to do. It's so easy for us to forget this principle. It's so easy for us to get caught up in the schedule of the everyday, always on, having to be somewhere, got things to do. We get caught up in the mundane. We get caught up in the routine. We get caught up in the drama or the politics or whatever it is we get caught up in. And we tend to forget that God has placed us where he's placed us to be peace makers, shalom makers, to be bringing the peace of the kingdom into our marriage, our neighborhood, our workplace. We forget. And so what happens is the drama happens, the politics happen, the bad thing occurs, whatever goes on, we get caught up in it and we react. We try to protect our kingdom. We try to protect my tower, the thing that I'm trying to build here. I want to get what I deserve. I want to make sure I'm seen for who I'm supposed to be. And we think it's about us, and we forget that it's about a whole other kingdom. We get deceived by the kingdom that we serve into thinking that we really are about that kingdom, when in reality, God's placed us here to serve in the name of another kingdom. And that's what Daniel was doing. That's what he did all along. And so what happens is, as Daniel is faithful to serve in this way, it didn't sit too well with everybody. Some people wanted to derail him. That's okay. We know this is going to happen. It's happening to Daniel and it's going to happen to you too, right? Jesus told us that it would happen that way. Because you serve another kingdom, well, Jesus is saying you're going to have problems with that. Jesus told us that the world hated me first, so naturally it's going to hate you. If you're a shalom bringer, if you're a servant of Jesus Christ, the world hates Jesus, so it's going to hate us. So, Daniel 6:5, they concluded, our only chance of finding grounds for accusing Daniel will be in connection with the rules of what? His religion. The only way they're going to be able to take this guy out is if they find some way to use his religion against him. So far, that hadn't been a problem over multiple kings and now multiple kingdoms. That hasn't really been a problem. In fact, every time Daniel's religion gets tested, he's proven to be victorious and the king promotes him, right? So now they're saying, well, his character, his integrity is good. So now there's nothing he's done wrong. So we got to invent something to make him look bad because of his religion. We've got to dream up some kind of crazy so that we can make him look bad just because he believes in God. This might sound a little preposterous until you look at our own culture. Isn't this the case in our own culture? Hasn't our culture had to invent crazy to make us, servants of another kingdom, look bad? I mean, who would have thought 50 years ago, who would have dreamed that it would be illegal to pray and to call the name of Jesus in public schools in a nation founded on the principle of religious liberty? Right. Yes. It's crazy. They got to invent something crazy. Who would ever believe 50 years ago that today the government would be paying money to support illegals while penalizing hardworking, legal, law-abiding Americans in a country where we value, you know, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps? You know, I mean, you got to invent crazy. Who would ever imagine that the grandchildren of those brave men who stormed the beach at Normandy and fought off the Nazis and defeated fascism a couple of generations ago, their very grandchildren are the ones whose college campuses have to have safe zones established so that they can be protected from words and ideas, right? I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's crazy how that's going on. Who would have believed that a nation who claims in God we trust have stolen God's very definition of marriage and redefined it, saying, no, we don't trust your definition of marriage. We think we have a better one. Crazy. They got to invent crazy for these things. Could you have ever believed that a nation would now say that the freedom of a man to pretend he's a woman and use a public women's restroom, that freedom is more valuable than the freedom of a mom to protect her young girls in that same restroom? Crazy. We have to invent crazy, and all of this puts us on the outs. It makes us look like the bad guys. It makes us look like we're the radical ones. We're the crazy ones, and we're the bad guys. And I just want to tell you, I just want to make sure I set your heart right on this. It's the next blank on your page. The kingdom of darkness will never understand the light. The kingdom of darkness is never going to comprehend. You know, we think we can see it so clearly, it makes so much sense because of our established worldview grounded in scripture and absolute truth. It makes so much sense, and the kingdom of darkness will never be able to comprehend it. It will never make sense to them. It's not because they have a faulty way of thinking. They're just in the darkness. It's just dark for them. So when we make a crazy, radical claim, and we talked about it last week, where we believe what Jesus says in John 14:6, that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one can come to the Father except for through him. We understand that this is an amazingly humble statement to make. Right? We realize that this is not some exclusive statement that we've got the way figured out and all you other people don't. We're not making some exclusive, arrogant, prideful statement. We're making the most humble statement we can possibly make. And what we're saying is that we really realize that all of us are broken by sin, myself included, and that I'm so broken by the very sin that I inherited and that I commit that it completely separates me from God. That if I want to reach some higher plane of existence, to put it in some kind of darkness terms, if I want to reach some transcendental level, if I want to know God, I can't. I can't. I'm not saying I have the exclusive in. I'm saying I can't. There's no amount of right. There's no amount of good. There's no amount of integrity I can have that will make me acceptable to a holy God. None of it can cover up what I've done and who I was. Because who I was a criminal against God. Who I was a treasonous, angry, rebellious criminal that deserved the punishment of death. And that's what I justifiably have coming to me. All of us are sinners in God's eyes, except for the fact that God loved us so much that he sent his Son, the way, the truth, and the life. And that Son of his lived a sinless life and had no sin of his own to pay for. So he goes to the cross, and on the cross, he dies not for his sins, but for my sins. Not for his arrogance and pride and anger and all that. He died for mine. He took the punishment for my sins. God judged Jesus instead of judging me. And Jesus pays my price on the cross, dies in my place, but he rises again and he lives in me and through me. He is the way. It's not my way. It's not what I can do. It's only what he has done. I could not do it myself. I needed someone else to do it for me. And so when we make the statement that we believe that Jesus is the one way, the one truth, and the one life, sounds arrogant to the world. Sounds exclusive, but we know it's humble. We know it's the only truth that matters. We know that we can't, and only he can. Am I right? So the world can't hear it, and they look at Daniel, and they can't see it. They see it, but they can't see it. And so in Daniel 6, it says this, so the administrators and the high officers, the jealous ones, they go to the king and they said, long live the king, long live King Darius. We're all in agreement, we administrators, officials, high officers, advisors, and governors, that the king should make a law that will be strictly enforced. Give orders for the next 30 days that any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except you, your majesty, will be thrown into the den of lions. And now, your majesty, issue and sign this law so it cannot be changed. An official law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be revoked. So King Darius signed the law. They just couldn't stand it that this believer was succeeding so well in their non-believer culture. That Daniel would have the gall to remember the letter from Jeremiah, who wrote in Jeremiah 29:7, work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, for its welfare. Pray to the Lord for it, for its welfare will determine your welfare. Daniel remembered that he worked in one kingdom, but he truly served another kingdom. And he never went along with the rest of the crowd, right? He never bowed to the idol. He never ate contrary to the dietary laws. He always was who he said he was. He stood and lived as the person that God called him to be. And like Daniel, in our non-believer culture, this seems to get harder and harder and harder. I had a conversation with a friend of mine this week, just this week, sitting at the coffee shop. And we were talking, and he was telling me that he just can't keep a good employee in this particular position at his business. He's got other employees and they do okay, but there's this one particular position that's a sort of a key position, and they got to be multitasking, multi-talented, do multi different things. And he said it's been really, really hard to keep somebody in this role. He's gone through person after person after person who just can't seem to measure up. But he is happy because he finally found someone. He finally found someone that now for about a month has been doing a really good job in this position. Best employee he's ever had. It just so happens that my boss, or the boss, the owner of the company, my friend who owns this company, he's a Christian, and the person he found that's the best for the job is not a Christian. In fact, not only are they not a Christian, this person is a transgender person. And so we're sitting there at the coffee shop, and he's saying, I don't get it. He said, I've had believers in and out of this job, and they steal, or they lie, or they don't come in on time, or they whatever. But I got this he, she in there, and this one is doing a great job serving the customers, handling all the orders, taking care of business, getting it all done. I'm like, wow, that's an amazing indictment on us, isn't it? And he said, well, I'll take it one step further. He says, I don't know how to deal with this person. He says, I'm a believer. I believe in the absolute truth of Scripture. And he says, I believe that gender is divinely given by God. It's a divinely given gift by God. You don't mess with gender. He says, so how do I talk to this person? How do I be the light to this person? How am I supposed to show this person Jesus? He said, if anything, this person acts more like Jesus than most of the believers that I've had in that position. And I'm like, oh man, that almost hurts to hear. It's hard in our culture now. How do we navigate this? He's like, I can't just sit there and smile and nod and pretend like everything's okay, yet I don't want to tick this person off and run them away. They're the best employee I've had. How do I deal with that? Not only that, but I got friends that work locally here, and I got a couple of friends that were talking the other day about this one person at their job who is blatantly, everybody knows about this, having extramarital affairs. Seems like everybody knows about this guy cheating on his wife except for the wife. And she's being played the fool. And these two Christians were talking about this guy, and they're like, what do I do? How do I deal with this? What do I do? I mean, do I just love and accept? Do I say something? Do I call her? What do I do? I got another friend who is an employee of a Christian boss, different company. And so employee, Christian boss, yet what he is seeing is he's seeing in this Christian boss some ways that the boss deals with money that are kind of sketchy, kind of shady, questionable at best. And this employee has great respect for this boss. He's a Jesus-loving boss, yet he's looking at the way the boss handles money, and he's going, now, hold on a minute. Something ain't right here. How do I deal with this? How do I approach this? Because what I'm seeing clearly isn't above board. What do I do? It's easy. It's easy for us to default to, well, I'll just smile and get along to go along. Everything will be okay. As a Christian, I'm just supposed to love, you know, so I want to make everyone feel good. I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. Is that what we're called to be? You see, I think we're not called to rally or to protest or to put up a big fight, but I do think we're called to be a Daniel-like example into the culture around us. Yes, I believe that we're called to love, but I also believe we're called to work for the peace, to be peacemakers. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. right? And I believe there is a huge difference, Sherry, between a peacemaker and a peacekeeper. You hear me? There's a huge difference between a peacemaker and a peacekeeper. You see, a peacekeeper is someone that smiles and gets along to go along. Go along to get along. How's that phrase go? I don't care. They just want to not cause any waves, not cause any ripples, don't ruffle any feathers. I just want to smile, and in the name of love, I just want everybody to be happy. Right? And so what that means is for Christians to do that is for us to just kind of blend into the background, for us to just kind of evaporate and make no difference at all. Right? Peacekeepers make little difference. We just try to keep the peace, but peacemakers have a whole different level of peace. Right? A peacekeeper is someone that can keep the peace of the world, but a peacemaker is somebody who is bringing shalom, bringing that undefinable, almost complete God peace that's all-encompassing, right? Someone who is a peacemaker is unlike the peacekeeper. The peacekeeper hides from the conflict. The peacemaker runs to the conflict. Right? The peacemaker smiles and pretends everything is okay. The peacemaker brings truth and love and grace into a situation. Right? A peacemaker hopes that nothing happens to upset the apple cart, whereas a peacekeeper does that. A peacemaker jumps in there and says, I will be part of bringing the peace of God into this situation and change it. See, the problem with us exiles is it's easy to default to the smile, nod, and get along to go along. And here's the thing, we're called to be salt, not sugar. We're called to be salt in this world and not sugar. We're called to make a difference. Salt, you got to remember salt, when Jesus is talking about you are the salt of the world, Jesus wasn't thinking about salt in the same way that we think about salt. We think about salt as a seasoning, period. Right? So you sprinkle it on something. And sure, it was used for that, I'm sure, during Jesus' day, but primarily, that is not what it was used for. What was salt used for in Jesus' day? A what? It was a preservative. Yeah. They didn't have refrigerators. They didn't have freezers. So if you want to keep something from going bad, you salted it up real good. You rubbed salt into it, right? And you made sure it was salted because it would decay quickly without salt. And salt would keep it from decay. And we, Jesus says, are to be the salt of the earth. It's decaying quickly. Maybe it seems that our culture is changing quickly and decaying rapidly because we've just lost our influence in this world. We've quit being salt and we've defaulted over to being sugar. Jesus says we're to be peacemakers, to go to the conflict. Great quote from D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, one of my favorite old-timey pastors. He says, for effectiveness, the Christian must retain his Christ-likeness as salt must retain its saltiness. If Christians become assimilated as non-Christians and contaminated by the impurities of the world, they lose their influence. The influence of Christians in and on society depends on their being distinct, not identical. In other words, you gotta be in the world, but you gotta live not of the world. There's got to be something different about me and you. There's got to be something that the world sees in us that's attractional to the real kingdom. And not everybody will love us for it, but we've got to be distinct, not identical, he says. The glory of the gospel is that when the church is absolutely different from the world, she invariably attracts it. It is then that the world is made to listen to her message, though it may hate it at first. May hate it at first, because when you rub salt into a wound, it will burn like fire, but ultimately it will preserve and help the healing happen more quickly. May hate it at first, but they desperately need to hear it. So they come against Daniel, inventing all the crazy to put him on the outs. And the king signs the decree against anyone who would pray to any other god. And Daniel's response is great. He knows exactly what to do in this situation. Let's have a protest, right? Let's rally everybody. Let's tear down some statues. Is that what he says? In verse 10, when Daniel learned that the law had been signed, he went home and he knelt down as usual in his upstairs room with his windows open toward Jerusalem. He throws open the windows facing towards Jerusalem and he kneels down. And I like what it says here. He prayed three times a day, just as he had always done, giving thanks to God. Daniel's pattern from the time he was a teenager forced into this non-believer culture until now, decades later, when he's in his 70s, was to pray on a fixed hour basis, to pray recurringly each day, to always pray three times a day facing Jerusalem. Yeah, he always stopped to remember what kingdom he truly served. For Daniel, Jerusalem was the city of God. Jerusalem is where the temple was, and the temple is the dwelling place of God. We don't pray towards Jerusalem today because we know that now, due to the Holy Spirit and the work of Christ on the cross, God lives in our hearts, in our lives, and he does not dwell in a particular geographic location. But at that time, Daniel was praying towards Jerusalem because that's where the city of God was. And he always spent time reorienting himself towards his home, reorienting himself towards his kingdom, remembering what kingdom he really served. And three times a day, he spent time reorienting himself. Wow. I mean, just think about that for a second. For us, when the king signs a decree against us today, what do we do? How do we respond? We fire off emails and we make snarky remarks on Facebook. We get together with our buddies and we shake our heads and roll our eyes and we talk about how bad it's getting, how bad the culture is spiraling out of control. But that's not at all what Daniel did. He faced home and he reoriented himself around who he really was. Isn't this who we ought to be? Why we get together in our little gossip circles and we talk about how bad everything is? Why we got to fire off all the snarky remarks online and all that stuff when, in fact, Daniel tells us to pray? Our first response, our always response, our anytime response ought to be to pray. Jesus himself taught us how to pray, right? In Matthew 6, you know this. He says, pray like this. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Now hold this here for 1 second. Look at this. Orienting around him, orienting around him, orienting around him. It's all about him. He doesn't say, hey, here's how you pray. God, please help me. No. He says, here's how you pray. Orient your heart around God. Focus on who he is. Get the big picture of his will on earth as it is in heaven. You live in one culture, but you serve another. Remember that this is about God, not about you. Daniel was strong all those years, from his teenage years into his 70s. And I think, next blank on your page, Daniel's strength was in his orientation. He always had his heart oriented to God. He prayed morning, noon, and night, three fixed times a day. I know. Some people say, oh, so Steve, you're going to advocate that we pray on regular bases, that we have certain times a day that we stop everything and pray. Sounds legalistic. And I'd just like to ask the question, great, how's your system working for you? I mean, what's your prayer system? I'm not going to stand here and say you got to pray in the morning, at noon, and at night. But when do you pray? For most of us, it's when the crisis happens. For most of us, it's only when the crisis happens. There is no systematic prayer in our lives. There is no systematic orientation of our hearts and minds around who God is. We just hope it happens by itself. When does anything in your life good just accidentally happen by itself? Not often, am I right? Yep. So I want to say that's why I really believe having a personal time alone with God daily is vital to us in this culture. It's vital to us as we serve a whole other culture in the middle of this one. Okay, I got to move on because I'm running out of time. So in verse 16 of Daniel 6, so at last the king, after being convinced, gave orders for Daniel to be arrested and to thrown in the den of lions. The king said to him, may your God, whom you serve so faithfully, rescue you. Now, I just want to say, that's not a sarcastic statement. The king loves Daniel. Daniel has served faithfully, and the king is heartbroken, we'll see, to have to do this to Daniel, but he signed the decree. And so he's hoping that Daniel will be saved. So a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. The king sealed the stone with his own royal seal and the seals of his nobles so that no one could rescue Daniel. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night fasting. He refused his usual entertainment and he couldn't sleep at all that night. Very early the next morning, the king got up and hurried out to the lion's den. When he got there, he called out in anguish, Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God, whom you serve so faithfully, able to rescue you from the lions? And Daniel answered, long live the king. My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths so that they would not hurt me, for I have been found innocent in his sight, and I have not wronged you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed and ordered that Daniel be lifted from the den. Not a scratch was found on him, for he had trusted in his God. And I just want to be really, really clear that this story is not about lions. This story is about the one who shuts the mouths of lions. This story is not about Daniel going into a den of lions, but it's about another one who went into a hole in the ground and had a stone rolled over the front and sealed. Right? It's about somebody else who went and made sure to conquer the worst nightmare of death for us. It's about somebody who 3 days later, that stone was rolled away and he stepped out unharmed. That's what the story is really about. And I'm sorry, I don't have time to go into all of it because I'm just out of time. But if you don't catch anything else, I want you to make sure you see this. This story is not about making sure you do the right thing so you'll be blessed by God. This story is about trusting in the one who shuts the mouths of lions. It's about saying that my way is faulty and broken. I don't even have a good system of prayer in my life. But there's someone who's better than all of that. There's somebody who can defeat the lions for me. And he is faithful to act on my behalf. Last blank I have on your page is this. Am I oriented toward the one who defeats lions? Am I oriented to him? Am I inclining my heart to him so that he can work and do what he wants to do in me?